Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and all the questions in. We've got a whole bunch of questions from social media, internet, YouTube. I'm sure that some of these came from YouTube, but meant to say email. Some people send them in via email. Jimmy Akin, thank you for coming back for another hour.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to do so.
Talking with you just a little bit at the break, that deep from the first hour had some... Had the question about AI and consciousness and could a computer ever become conscious, that kind of thing. And you, mm-hmm. you wanted to add to your remarks from the first hour.
Yeah, I just thought I'd mention something. This is not of crushing, you know, significance, but it's just a little personal story. I have various ideas that I keep for fiction that I might write someday. And I almost never write fiction because I've got too much nonfiction I need to write. This is going back to our question about time management and the economic problem of how do you use which talents you got from last hour. So I almost never write fiction, but I do have ideas, and I even sometimes keep lists of them. But I had an idea that basically duplicates The Chinese Room. And I developed it independently. I didn't even know about The Chinese Room at the time. But I duplicated it with a modification that actually makes the point even clearer. Because in The Chinese Room, you've got a person, a human who is conscious of something that is applying the rules to mm-hmm. To select what's an appropriate response to which query. My independent duplication of it doesn't have that. So if I were to write I've thought about writing what essentially would be a science fantasy novel mm-hmm. where, or at least science fantasy story, where one of the characters is a robot called Babbage. Babbage is because that he played an important role in the development of modern computers. So that's a name from history. Anyway, the story has this character named Babbage who's basically a robot, but he's a dumb robot. He does not have artificial intelligence, but he looks like he's perfectly intelligent because what is revealed in the story is that Babbage is just an interface that connects to a massive print library. You've got somewhere in the world, there is a massive library of print books. And in these print books are every question or statement that is likely to ever be made to Babbage with a printed response that is appropriate. And so what happens is when you say something to Babbage, there's a link to this library, and in the library there's a robot that looks up, okay, what's the thing that was just said, and then it just reads back the appropriate response. So the rule is super simple. It's not a complex set of rules. Maybe an army of humans wrote all these responses, but they're on paper now, and so it's just a lookup function. And that's mm-hmm. the only rule. Look up what was said, read the response. And so you can have a conversation with Babbage, and you can ask Babbage to give you ideas and all kinds of things. And he can be a character that plays an important role in the story, but he's based entirely on a lookup function and is not actually intelligent at all and has no consciousness. He just acts like he does because that's what's written in the responses.
Yeah, it's a
this is like The Chinese Room, only I've taken the human out of the picture and replaced it with a library of books.
The problem with us though is as human beings, I think it's in our nature to be empathetic to a certain mm-hmm. degree. So
the characters in the story will treat Babbage as if he were an intelligent being.
Oh, that's
until maybe I make that a plot point and they have to sacrifice him and they realize, oh, he's just a computer. We'll just get a new interface.
Yeah. 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 But we, it's, we're just, I mean, I think children are particularly vulnerable, or not invulnerable, vulnerable to this. We've got to be really careful with children and AI, because they, the child does not, cannot do what you just said your characters will do. Ah, it's nothing. It's, so I think we've got to be really careful on that front. I would like to read about Babbage someday.
Well, maybe I'll write about it someday.
All right. I was trying to get a promise out of you, but that came with a maybe. This question comes from TunaFish262. I attend the Tridentine Mass almost exclusively at my local FSSP parish. I have a friend seeking the Catholic Church who asked me, why do you have two different Masses in the Western Rite? Why don't you just attend the regular English one? I often say that I am drawn to the beauty and simplicity of it. How do we respond to this simply without dragging them into the so-called liturgy wars? How do we respond given the restrictions placed on the older Mass? Basically, how do we address this difference to those outside the church? Do I just keep a response about preferences of the faithful?
Well, I think that's an important component of responses one might give to these questions, but there are different questions here, so let's go through them one at a time. The first one is, why do you have two different Masses in the Western Rite? Actually, we have more than that. There's also like the Dominican usage, there's an Ambrosian usage, there's an Anglican usage. So actually, there are multiple different forms of the liturgy in the Latin Rite. The Tridentine form is one of them. And I would say that the reason we have multiple forms is the same reason we have multiple different liturgical rites in the first place, like the Chaldean rite and the Maronite rite and, the Syro-Malabar rite and so forth. The reason we have these different rites is they serve the needs of the people who use them. So there's good in all of these rites, and there's certainly good in the Tridentine form of Mass. The church used it for centuries, and so there is good in it. And then after the Second Vatican Council, it was proposed that we do a revision. That revision was made and became the new order of Mass. But just because there was a revision didn't mean everybody found that to best serve their needs. Some people thought that the older form of Mass served their needs, and so the church decided to have it available as an option among others in the church more broadly and in the Latin Rite specifically. Then there's the second question. Why don't you just attend the regular English one? And TunaFish says, I often say that I'm drawn to the beauty and simplicity of it. And that's fine. You could also express it the way you do later about preferences to the faithful. It's just my preference. I prefer going to it. And that's totally fine. And you don't need to get into liturgy wars or go beyond that. Now, if they then ask you, well, what about the restrictions that Pope Francis placed on the Tridentine rite of Mass? I would say, there are some people who attend the Tridentine Mass who were causing problems in the church, and some of them even denying that Francis was Pope, and he judged that it was appropriate to place additional restrictions on it to combat those problems. However, not everybody agreed with that judgment, and so different people have different opinions. Pope Leo may take a different tack. So, it's a subject on which people have different opinions, and we don't need to, go beyond that, especially when just having a basic discussion with someone. So that's how I wouldn't immerse them in the liturgy wars. I'd say, well, there's value to having different rites of Mass that serve different people. I personally prefer this one, and there are differences of opinion about what the best way to handle problems in the church is, and different opinions about what availability there should be for the Tridentine rite.
TunaFish 262, thank you very much for the question. We'll take a quick break. Right back with more questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, featuring Mother Angelica, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Father Benedict Groeschel. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, Jimmy Akin, our guest. All the questions in, a whole bunch of great questions. And this one comes from the Senate and People of Sean, I think. It's SPQ
no,
Sean.
No, I think you just leapt over another question.
Did I do that again? I am so sorry. Hang on, SPQ Sean. AJ Arthur 5136, that's where we are. Mm-hmm. AJ Arthur wanted to know this. I don't know if he's related to Chester. The Church has been quite vocal against usury over the centuries. Is it still defined as any kind of money, as any lending of money at interest? How does this notion square with the idea of a variable money supply? Would things like bank accounts, bonds, CDs, or stocks still be considered illicit? Has there been any recent guidance from the Magisterium?
Okay, so I'll answer A.J. Arthur's question, but first I want to compliment you, Cy, on the way you pronounced usury. You pronounced it usury.
Yes.
And that's unexpected, because normally in English pronunciation, when an S is intervocalic, meaning it is between two vowels, like S in usury is, it's between two U's, you pronounce it as Z. So normally with an intervocalic S like that, we would say usury, but you said usury. You kept it as a... As an S sound. This is incidentally why we say Jesus, not Jesus. So interesting pronunciation.
So why am I getting complimented for that though? Because I have no idea why I did it.
I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, it's quirky.
But it would benefit you in studying Greek, because one of the problems I have, the name of our Lord in Greek is Jesus. But people are so used to pronouncing it with an intervocalic Z sound that they want to say Jesus, and Jesus' name is not Jesus in Greek, it's Jesus.
Sounds like you're cheering for a Roman, it sounds like you're cheering for a Greek god. Jesus. Sorry,
well,
I'm sorry.
That I don't know about, but but the fact that you resisted an intervocalic Z would set you in good stead for pronouncing Greek.
All right. There you go.
Okay. So in regard to A.J. Arthur's question, there's definitely been a shift in the Church's understanding of usury. It still maintains a teaching against usury, but the notion has been refined. Originally, usury was understood at any taking of interest on a loan. And in a pre-modern economy, that was more of a problem than it is today. And today we have better economic understanding. We have economies that are not zero-sum games. It's been recognized that there is a value to compensating someone by allowing them to have a reasonable amount of interest on a loan that they give you. That, among other things, incentivizes them to give you a loan. And that then, and you can use that loan to make profit. And since they don't have the money while it's in your custody, it's reasonable for them to also benefit from the profit you made by giving them a portion of it. And that way you both benefit. Whereas if you said no interest can be taken, well, then they'd be less likely to give you a loan, you'd be less likely to make a profit, and they would be less likely to make a profit. So you can see how some level of interest taking promotes the development of the economy and the prosperity of multiple people. That's why we're in an economy today that is not zero sum, but instead is based around wealth creation rather than just moving wealth around from one person to another. So this shift in church thinking began as early as, I want to say, the 14th century. There were some places in Italy during the Renaissance that were experimenting along these lines, and the church didn't have a problem with it. But certainly by the 20th century, the church had had a shift in its position. What it has not done, as far as I've been able to tell, is give us a clear definition of what they're now considering usury. You will find places where they preach against usury, but in those places, they don't offer us a clear definition. It seems to me that kind of the best definition that I could give you today for what the church is treating as usury is not all taking of interest, but excessive taking of interest, taking too much interest in a way that harms the person you're giving the loan to rather than actually helping them, you know, like a loan sharking situation. Okay, I'll give you $500, but you're going to owe me $500 next week, and the person's unlikely to have made a $500 profit in that time. So they're going to end up breaking your legs. You know, that's a caricature, but that's you know, kind of the kind of situation that could arise in loan sharking that would be excessive interest. So I think that's about the best I can do in terms of giving a definition of usury today. It's not an official one, but it's the one I get from the vibe that comes from reading church documents on this subject. I would say that currently we're in a period of doctrinal development with the concept of usury. The church has recognized there is a concept here that is true and needs to be preserved, but currently they're letting theologians and others kind of experiment with this idea and try to figure it out more precisely. And after a consensus emerges, they may offer an explanation in more detail of what usury is to be understood to be today. But originally it was just all interest.
Yeah.
Now they're kind of letting the concept float and be experimented with because they've recognized not all interest is bad. And we may get future developments on this.
AJ Arthur 5136, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy, I asked my computer, why did I pronounce usury? And you know what it said? It said, you're British. That's the British.
They do that sometimes.
Yeah, I didn't know that I was British, but all right.
They also sub in Z for S in some situations that aren't even intervocalic. Like you listen to some British speakers and they'll say us instead of us.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how I picked up their bad habits, their rotten speaking habits. But I don't think they have Z. I don't think they have the letter Z over there. Don't they have the letter Z?
Well, they call it by a different name, but yeah. It's the same sound.
Now I can get to SPQ Sean, isn't that the beginning of that Senate and People of Rome thing that you see around SPQR?
Only you need an R on the end of it instead of a Sean.
So this is the Senate and People of Sean. I beg your pardon, SPQ Sean. Does just war theory apply to rebellions? Historically, I'm thinking of Irish wars against the British Empire and slave revolts of African-descended people in the Americas, including during the U.S. Civil War. What would be the conditions of jus ad bellum in cases like these or any other group dealing with an oppressor?
Okay, so I'll definitely answer the question. First, though, SPQ Sean comments on some historical situations like Irish wars against British Empire and various slave revolts in the Americas. And there were slave revolts in the Americas. I don't think there weren't any major ones in the U.S. Civil War. In fact, that was remarkably free of such rebellions. There were African Americans who, actually some who fought on both sides, but there were African Americans who fought against who fought during the war, including against the Confederacy, but that wasn't a rebellion. That was part of an organized military force. They were part of the federal forces, where there had before the war been things like John Brown's failed rebellion. And in Haiti, they did have a slave revolt that kicked out the French. That was the Haitian Revolution, and they won their independence. It started in 1891. And it took 12 years to accomplish, but they won. And, you know, so credit to them. So just a few historical notes there. In terms of the conditions for jus ad bellum, or the law or justness of going to war, the Catechism actually has a paragraph that deals with this. It's paragraph 2243, and it says armed resistance. So armed, notice this is we're fighting now. Armed resistance to oppression by political authority is not legitimate unless all the following conditions are met. And it names five conditions. One, there is certain grave and prolonged violation of fundamental rights. Two, all other means of redress have been exhausted. Three, such resistance will not provoke worse disorders. Four, there is a well-founded hope of success. And five, it is impossible to reasonably to foresee any better solution. So the Catechism gives you a nice handy list of exactly what needs to obtain in order to give armed resistance to oppression by political authority. And just to, I guess, kind of revisit those criteria for a moment, you know, there needs to be certain grave and prolonged violation of fundamental rights. You know, if whatever the oppression is a mild inconvenience or just a temporary thing, then they don't want you fighting about it. But if it's certain, grave, and prolonged, that condition is fulfilled. Then all other means of redress have been exhausted. So, you know, vote the scoundrels out needs to have been tried and failed, assuming you're living in a democracy. Or maybe you could get a law case, you know, that would settle the issue rather than having to go to war about it. But you need to have exhausted anything other than armed resistance. So you need to try everything else first. Third, the resistance must not provoke worse disorders. If there's currently a certain grave and prolonged violation of rights and you go to war and it makes things worse, well, then it would have been better not to go to war. So that's the third condition. It's better to live with a bad situation than create an even worse situation. Four, there needs to be a well-founded hope of success. You know, if you're just destined to lose, well, then it's better not to fight because people's lives are going to be taken. And if you have no hope of winning, if there needs to be a well-founded hope of winning, then if you don't have that hope, then a bunch of people are going to die. There's going to be a bunch of destruction and a bunch of suffering, and you may as well not go down that path. And then finally, it's impossible to reasonably foresee any better solution. And, you know, again, would be kind of obvious. If you can foresee a better solution than going to war over something or leading a rebellion against something, then you should pursue the other better solution. So those are the five criteria that need to be met in order to have armed resistance to oppression by political authority.
SPQ, Sean. Thank you very, very much. It does seem kind of like high standards, Jimmy. I guess that is part of the whole deal.
Well, starting a shooting conflict is not something to be taken lightly. You want to cross your T's and dot your I's before you do that.
You don't want to be out there like Yosemite Sam, just shooting the place up?
Nope.
Tell me what dropped on Monday on the Jimmy Akin podcast.
Okay, so this most recent Monday, I had an episode on Did Jesus Have a Miraculous Birth? Not was he miraculously conceived? Everybody agrees on that. But did he have a miraculous birth itself? And there are different opinions on that. And I talk about what that range of opinions and what the church teaches. And then I also talk about some evidence we have on this question, which is startlingly early and comes from within 34 years of the crucifixion. Then, coming up this next Monday, I have an episode on three teachings that are accepted by our Protestant friends, even though they're not in the Bible. And they're not stated in the Bible, they are not implied in the Bible, and so the only basis for them would be apostolic tradition.
I apologize to any Yosemite Sam fans. He seems like a fine person in many ways. All right, we've got to take a very quick break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Check out the Jimmy Akin podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or do visit Jimmy's YouTube channel to find new episodes each week. Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Do you have what it takes to defend your Catholic faith? The work of apologetics takes study, practice, and skill. But more than anything, it takes spiritual strength. The Soul of Apologetics, a new prayer resource from Catholic Answers, gives you the spiritual tools every Catholic apologist needs: prayers, meditations, and scripture-based reflections to build up the interior life. Order your copy of The Soul of Apologetics today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. A little bit of groovy music for you on this Friday afternoon, maybe Friday evening. Maybe we're waking you up on a Saturday morning if you're over there in the Philippines or Australia or Singapore or Japan. Wherever you are, as I like to say, we're glad you're here with us. Jimmy Akin's also here with us, and we've got a whole bunch of questions for him. Just whatever questions for Jimmy. We get a lot of questions for Jimmy Akin. This one comes from Music Maker 1026. Canon 7. Of Chalcedon, mm-hmm. or Chalcedon, mm-hmm. forbids clergy and monks from war and holding secular office. Mm-hmm. How then did the Knights Templar and bishops, such as the Bishop of Andorra, who holds the title of co-prince of Andorra, not violate this?
Okay, well, the canons of the early ecumenical councils tended not to be, or frequently were not, doctrinal statements. Like, for example, at the Council of Nicaea, they were legal in nature. They were regulatory. Like, for example, at the First Council of Nicaea, the doctrinal thing it did was promulgate the Nicene Creed that defined the divinity of Christ. But it also issued like 20 canons, and the canons were legal regulations about what should and should not happen in the church. They weren't doctrinal teachings. And so Canon 7 from Chalcedon, it may be based on a doctrinal principle, you know, but fundamentally it's a legal regulation, and legal regulations can change with time. And so centuries later, now Chalcedon happened in the 400s, and the Templars didn't exist until the 11th or 12th century. So canon law had simply changed substantially by that time and allowed for the creation of military orders. And, you know, my understanding is that also had the Pope sign off at the time. And the Pope is the legislator of the law of the church. And so if the Pope approves something, it overrides earlier legislation. And so even if Canon 7 had still been in effect up to the point that the military orders, and it wasn't just the Templars, there were other military orders too connected with the Crusades. But even if Canon 7 of Chalcedon had been in effect in the West, up to the time of the creation of the military orders, they got the required papal sign-off, and so so a new law applied at that time. When it comes to the Prince Bishop of Andorra, he's kind of an exception. There were periods in church history where things in a particular area got bad enough that the people turned to church authorities for governmental functions. And in fact, the Pope himself was an example of this. You know, as political authority fell apart in the Italian peninsula, there were there was a need for someone to step up to the plate and start doing governmental functions, and people turned to one of the institutions in society that was still around, even as the state was falling apart, and that was the papacy. And so the Pope ended up becoming the head of the so-called papal states, which was a situation that persisted until 1870. So the Pope himself was an exception, and so was the Prince Bishop of Andorra. Andorra is a very, very small place in Europe, but it does have a bishop as one of its co-rulers, and that's an exceptional nature, both in terms of historical origin. It's also an exception in terms of current canon law, because current canon law indicates that that priests, and therefore bishops, should not be holding secular office. And when that canon was implemented in 1983, I'd have to check about the exact date of when this happened, but there was a Jesuit who was a member of the U.S. Congress named Robert Drynan. And it was during the reign of John Paul II, and Drynan, I think, argued, you know, like, can I be grandfathered in here? And they said no, and he had to resign from the U.S. House of Representatives because they really didn't want priests engaged in government affairs. But the situation with the Prince Bishop of Andorra had lasted for centuries, and they haven't applied it to this rule to him in the same way. So he has, he may have a rescript allowing him, or a privilege, a private law that allows him to remain in office, but it would cause a bunch of upsets. He's not just a representative in a House of legislature. He's like a co-top guy. Mm-hmm. In the nation. And so, and it's largely a ceremonial office anyway, so they've let him keep it.
Music Maker? No, that was Music Maker 1026. Music Maker 1026. Thank you very much for the question. I thought this was Andor the Second, but then I realized that's an L. So Andoril. And that is a very cutting name. That's a sharp name. and Duril.
Uh-huh. Okay, I can see that. Reminds me of Zur-En-Arr, the alternate planet Batman.
Oh, no. And Duril is the sword of Aragorn in the Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Points for knowing that.
Yeah. That's not much else I know. I know the Lord of the Rings. That's about it. How does baptism fit with faith alone working through love? Can someone with faith alone working through love be initially justified apart from baptism?
Okay, so there's two questions here. How does faith alone fit with, how does baptism fit with faith alone working through love? Well, Sykelet, if you have faith that works through love, who are we talking about loving?
I would say God and neighbor.
God and neighbor, good. And so if you have faith working through love, then that means you're going to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. So if you love God and God wants you to be baptized, are you going to get baptized?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. So faith working through love is going to, you don't need the adjective alone in there, although you can have it in there if you want. But what's important is faith working through love. That's going to lead you to get baptized. Or if you don't yet have faith working through love and you get baptized, well, then it'll give you faith working through love. So it'll be a fruit of baptism. So those are two ways that faith working through love can relate to baptism. It could lead you to get baptized, or if you don't have it prior to baptism, it will give you faith work. Baptism will give you faith working through love, and so you would have it. So either way, that's how faith working through love can relate to baptism. Can someone with faith working through love be initially justified apart from baptism? Yes. If you have faith working through love, that's, I'm going to use a fancy word, that's biconditional with justification. So biconditional means two things always go together, like the head of a coin and the tail of the coin. They're biconditional. They always go together. If you have faith working through love, you are in a state of justification. And you can have that before baptism because, as we just covered, faith working through love would lead you to do what God wants and get baptized. So, yes, you can have it beforehand, and this reflects the statement of St. Augustine, we are bound by the sacraments, but God is not. He can give his grace to anybody. And so if he gives you the grace to have faith working through love, and if he'll also correspondingly give you the grace of justification, even if you have not yet been baptized.
Anduril, thank you very much.
Oh, go ahead. And I should say, this is the explanation for why catechumens who die before baptism can be saved. You know, you go back to church fathers like St. Augustine, and he'll say, yeah, some of these catechumens who died before they could be baptized, they're definitely in heaven. And this is why.
Again, thank you for the question. I think we'll go straight to the break. We'll come back. We've got a little bit of time to get to several more questions. Jimmy Akin, our guest on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
This is Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. I know for a fact that we have brothers and sisters who are not Catholic, who are not even believers in Jesus, who listen to Catholic radio because they're looking for something that's going to edify their souls. They're searching for truth, and they're not finding it in sports radio or political talk radio. They're finding it with Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Jimmy Akin, our guest, Catholic Answers Live. We've got about a million questions for him. And so we can do this all day if we want to. Jimmy, this one comes from CL Rob 44, and she has one from her husband and one from herself. So we'll do the one she sent from her husband first. Her husband wants to know, what do you think is the most convincing argument / thought exercise against naturalism / imperialism, or at least what the average
imperialism is a whole different thing.
Empiricism, yes, or at least what the average indifferent secular person thinks they believe. I see.
Well, there are a number of approaches that I could take, but one of the ones that I tend to favor is pointing to evidence we have from near-death experiences, because near-death experiences occur when someone's heart has stopped and they thus blood is not being driven to the person's brain. And if your brain didn't get blood, it goes offline in like 10 to 15 seconds. So people who are in a state of cardiac arrest simply should not have ongoing conscious experiences, and yet they do. And we have good evidence that they do, not for due to a variety of reasons. One of them is people report the same kinds of experiences. This isn't like a dream where people have all different kinds of dreams. They all tend to report the same set of events. Some people remember part of the sequence, others remember other parts, but it's the same fundamental sequence. And that gives evidence that these experiences are real. But beyond that, we have what's called veridical information that comes back from some of these experiences, which is information that is too specific to be guessed by random chance. It is information that the person did not know before they had the experience, and it is information that turns out to be true. So that's what veridical information is. It's true information that you didn't know and can't be explained by random chance. And there are lots of near-death experiences where there is veridical information. In fact, just to give you one resource, if you're interested, there's a book co-authored by a man named Titus Rivas, R-I-V-A-S. It's called The Self Does Not Die. And it's a collection of more than 100 near-death experiences that all have veridical information that was verified by medical professionals. So to give an example, I've used this one before, but it's a good one. This is Maria's shoe. There is a woman, this is like back in the 70s. There's a woman named Maria who is from Latin America. She was a Spanish speaker. She came to the Pacific Northwest here in the United States. And while she was there, she had a heart attack. She had cardiac arrest. They took her to the hospital. They started working on her, and they got her heart restarted. After her heart was restarted, she's talking away in Spanish, and this being like the 1970s, there aren't a lot of hospital workers in the Pacific Northwest who knew Spanish at this time. So they find one who did know some Spanish. She comes in, she talks to Maria, and Maria says, While I was dead, I floated above my body. I saw them trying to get my heart restarted. I also started seeing other things elsewhere in the hospital. And I saw on a ledge outside of one of the rooms on one of the upper floors, a blue men's tennis shoe that had scuff marks and a shoelace wrapped around it. I need to know what my experience was. Was that real? Can you go see if that shoe exists? And so the hospital worker started looking around on the upper floors of the hospital, and outside on the ledge of one of the rooms was a blue men's tennis shoe with scuff marks and a shoelace wrapped around it. She went out on the ledge, retrieved the shoe, came down and showed it to Maria. So, you know, the idea that, so this is veridical information. Maria did not know about that shoe before she had her NDE experience. It turned out to be true that there was such a shoe, and this is too specific to be something you could guess by random chance. So this is vertical information that confirms the reality of this near-death experience. And this is far from the only case. Like I said, in The Self Does Not Die, there are over 100 of these where medical personnel verified the information. Another one that I really like is this guy has a near-death experience. He's in the hospital. He also perceives himself as, you know, floating high in the room and looking down. And he sees the doctors working on him. And one of the doctors, he sees flapping his arms, like kind of like a chicken. And this is bizarre behavior, and no other doctors do that. So after they revived him, he said, "Why were you flapping your arms like a chicken?" And it turned, and the doctor got a little irritated, but it turned out this, so this was a Japanese doctor, and in Japan, when he was in medical school, he had gotten into a safety habit that other doctors didn't do. Of when he was in a surgical theater, you know, he's got clean, he scrubbed his hands, he's got surgical gloves on. He doesn't want to touch anything in the surgery that could get germs on his hands. Mm-hmm. So for the protection of his patients in the surgery, he would keep his hands to himself and gesture with his elbows to things that he wanted.
And this guy saw that.
And this guy saw that while his heart, from above, while his heart was stopped. So I would say we've got really good evidence that conscious experiences occur when the brain is shut down. And that suggests that naturalism or empiricism or materialism or whatever you want to call it is an incomplete and erroneous description of the world we live in, because it does not have any place for this type of experience. And this suggests that consciousness is not dependent on the brain, because the brain was shut down when people had these accurate experiences. So that would be my answer to RC Rob 44's husband.
Okay, so let's go to RC Rob 44, her own question. And she says, what is your best advice for a married Catholic couple to strengthen their bond in marriage? Your stories about you and Renee are always so beautiful, the bluebirds especially, she puts parenthetically. Mm-hmm. Also, thanks for being a Catholic cowboy. I grew up Southern Baptist, and seeing a Southern Catholic gentleman do apologetics is really cool. Oh, that's very nice.
Well, thank you, CL Rob. And I'll mention, for people who may not know what the Bluebirds are, there is a local pottery studio here in outside of Fayetteville, Arkansas, called Terra Studios. And they're famous for making these little glass figurines out of blue glass. They're called the Bluebirds of Happiness. And I have a pair of them behind me on the shelf. And to me, they represent me and my late wife, Renee. In terms of the question, what's my best advice for a married Catholic couple to strengthen their bond in marriage? Well, I guess I would have several pieces of advice. They may or may not be practical in individual situations, but, you know, the first thing I would do is really focus on loving your neighbor. That includes your spouse. And think, how can I be a loving person? I would read and meditate on the different passages in the New Testament that talk about relations, interpersonal relations between husbands and wives, and, you know, how they should conduct themselves. Ephesians has a passage like that, but it's not the only one. And I would look at the relationship between Christ and the church, which St. Paul uses as a model of the relationship between husband and wife. I would, if I were the wife, I'd think, how can I respond more to my husband like I was responding to Christ? And if I was the husband, I would think, how can I respond more to my wife the way Christ would respond to his church? And that means, among other things, self-sacrificing for the church. So I also would think in terms of any problems we have at the moment, as long as we work together, we can get through them. You know, they may be unpleasant, but we'll get through them and it'll be okay. So don't treat any current problems like they're the end of the world, because they're not. and or they at least don't have to be. So make a commitment to each other and, you know, kind of relax and recognize, yeah, there are going to be problems, but we'll get through them and it'll be okay. I would also say spend time together, you know, find good, have some spouse time where you're not around other people. You don't have to interact with other people. You can just enjoy each other's company, and whatever you both enjoy would be a good thing to do. Or sometimes maybe it's what the husband enjoys. Sometimes it's what the wife enjoys. But just finding a way to spend time together and have a good time is a good thing that can help strengthen the marriage. Also, don't neglect the physical side of the relationship. This is something St. Paul talks about. He says, don't deny each other except perhaps for a time, you know, like so you could devote yourself to prayer. But make sure that you're cultivating the physical side of your relationship and not neglecting it. Also, in terms of bonding, well, they call kids the tie that binds. So, you know, think about having kids or having another kid or more kids. Those are some of the things that occur to me, but fundamental is being a loving person towards your spouse. No matter who the spouse is, whether you're the husband or the wife, be loving to your spouse, and love covers a million problems in the end. Just maintain a, you know, a caring, loving attitude, and you can get through just about anything.
CL, thank you very much for both questions, your husband's and yours. This one comes from Mark. Mark wanted to know, Peter denied Jesus three times. After the cock crows three times, he ran away in shame. What? Well, that's not exactly how that story went, but what if he falls, hits his head, and dies after this? Would his soul be in danger of damnation?
Okay, well, St. Peter had the reassurance, this is in Luke 22, before this incident happened, that Jesus had prayed for him and he would turn back. So he had assurance from Jesus that actually he wasn't going to die that night. But setting that aside, what if he did? What if Jesus had not given him that assurance? And so Peter denies Jesus three times, and then the cock crows and he runs away in shame, and he trips, falls, hits his head, and dies. What would be the state of his soul at this point? Well, it would depend on exactly what he'd done. Denying Christ is the kind of thing that can jeopardize your salvation. And there are different degrees of denying Christ. One of the things that Mark says in his account of this is that Peter began to curse. And it has been proposed that when Mark says that, he doesn't mean, you know, that Peter started to use bad words. He wasn't cussing in the modern sense. Instead, it's been proposed that he started to curse Christ to prove that he was not a follower of Christ. Now, you know, the fact he was afraid is a mitigating factor for his personal responsibility, but it doesn't completely remove responsibility. There have been loads of people who were called upon to be martyrs for their faith, and just because they were afraid wouldn't justify them denying Christ. So we can't just let Peter off the hook because of his fear here. We especially can't do that if he took the more dramatic step of cursing Christ. So he would have reason to question the salvation of his soul. On the other hand, he also may have effectually repented before he tripped. I mean, the whole reason he's running away at this point is he's in shame. And if he's repented out of love of Jesus, you know, love of God, well, if that repentance had reached a point where he said, man, that was awful, I would never want to do that again, so that he had effectively turned his will against the action that he had just taken, then even if he had sinned mortally in the denials, he could have been rehabilitated of them. He could have returned to a state of grace via his repentance. Now, what would have actually happened in this situation? I don't know. I'm not inside Peter's head, and this is a hypothetical situation that departs from the timeline of our actual world. You know, I had to we had to do that in order to even get Peter dead in this scenario. But I would say there would be reason for concern for his soul, but also some reason for hope for his soul. And I couldn't give you a definitive answer of what would happen. That's for God to judge in this alternate timeline, not for me.
Not willing to judge souls, Jimmy? What kind of an apologist are you? Thank you very much for the 2 hours.
No problem. I did hear something about don't judge others, so I'm going to invoke that here.
I believe I have heard that as well. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. We did mention a couple times Jimmy's book, Teaching with Authority. Do check that out. Also check out Jimmy's podcasts, two of them, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin Podcast. You can find them both on his YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. That will do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.